Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president wants to cut the deficit. Republicans want to cut the deficit. But how do they get from here to there? There's no deficit of politics on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 26th of January. Good to have you with us. So there I was last night, watching the State of the Union, and just about the time that the president was saying this.
Tonight, I am proposing that starting this year, we freeze annual domestic spending for the next 5 years. Now, this would reduce the deficit by more than $400 billion over the next decade.
So just about then, I was reading something interesting on my laptop, doing a little multitasking. It was a plan by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul to cut spending a whole lot more, $500 billion in the next 8 months. He gets there by shutting down whole chunks of the government. But between the two, $40 billion a year for a decade, as the president wants, and $500 billion right now, surely there's some middle ground. Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
When you look at the federal budget, the part the president wants to freeze doesn't amount to a whole lot.
That, of course, is the smallest part of the budget.
Maya McGinnis is a fellow at the New America Foundation. She says discretionary domestic spending covers things like roads and bridges, education and housing programs. But it doesn't include
all the various checks that the government sends out or services it gives directly to people for health care, retirement, public pensions.
McGinnis is talking about Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. She says entitlement programs have to be on the table right alongside defense spending. Don Kettle agrees. He teaches public policy at the University of Maryland. He says if politicians want to reduce the deficit, they should follow the Dillinger rule.
People asked John Dillinger why he robbed banks, and he said, well, that's where the money is, and if we're interested in trying to balance the budget, we're going to have to follow the Dillinger rule and go where the money is.
But Kettle says Rand Paul's plan is too radical.
You would have to try to tell some grandmother that maybe she can't have her wheelchair when she comes out of a hospital into nursing care. You'd be talking about nothing but truly unpalatable options to be able to get to numbers that large.
Still, Maya McGinnis says Paul's plan and the president's do have something in common.
These are very large cuts that they're talking about. Whether you're looking at somebody like Rand Paul's proposal or the president's, they're much larger cuts than we've seen in the past, and we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking they're going to be painless.
But middle ground sure is hard to find. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The next wannabe bestseller has all the right ingredients. It's got greed and deception and nudity. Well, maybe some naked short selling, anyway. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report hits store shelves tomorrow. The 9/11 Commission report and some others as well wound up actually being bestsellers. But this one, that is a tougher sell, as Marketplace's Janet Babin explains.
Would you buy a book by these guys?
Welcome to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's website. I'm Chairman Phil Angelides.
And I'm Bill Thomas, Vice Chairman.
The affable tones of the commission members might not translate into a best-selling page-turner. The first print run of the commission's report is just 25,000 copies in paperback. But analyst Michael Norris at Simba Information says the book could become a hit.
It's probably going to do well. I see it's already 200 and something on Amazon's bestseller rank. And, you know, as word about it gets out, it might actually do much better than that.
The 9/11 Commission report became a bestseller with more than a million copies purchased. Even the Starr report, the investigative account of President Bill Clinton by independent counsel Kenneth Starr, made bestseller lists. But this topic, starring characters like credit default swaps and collateral debt obligations, presents more of a challenge. Marissa Glucks, managing partner at Radar Research.
The mismanagement of our financial system is a lot more complicated than whether or not Bill Clinton had sex with an intern.
And the book will face stiff competition. The financial crisis has already spawned a mini industry of popular titles from people who are closer to the drama than commission members were. If they want their work to be read, Gluck recommends the commission members get themselves a top-notch publicist.
You know, the only way to really ensure this is a bestseller is to have Glenn Beck flog it on his show. This may hold some appeal to a section of the Tea Party.
Or maybe Stephen Colbert has an opening. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The National Football League has got to be pretty excited about its Super Bowl matchup. The Green Bay Packers and the Pittsburgh Steelers are two of the most recognizable franchises the NFL has. But that's not really the only reason that Super Bowl parties this year are expected to be bigger than ever, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The National Retail Federation expects consumers to spend the most ever this year, more than $10 billion on the Super Bowl. We're not just talking about bean dip and chips. The NRF's Kathy Grannis says that may include a new TV for nearly 5% of viewers. It's all about throwing the best party on the block.
And a large part of impressing your family and friends is really making sure that they can see the game in high definition on the latest and greatest TV that you can get your hands on.
But wait, didn't we just emerge from this horrible recession when the Super Bowl was seen as a sign of American excess? General Motors was out of the game during the downturn, and one of the few bright spots was this Snickers ad.
You're playing like Betty White out there.
Ask out what your girlfriend says.
Last year, it was plain and simple, pretty boring.
Food analyst Phil Lempert says this year, GM's back. So is Pepsi, and Best Buy's among many new Super Bowl advertisers.
I think this year the Super Bowl ads are going to be more creative, and for those who are smart, bigger than ever.
Brad Adgate of Horizon Media says Super Bowl commercials have been sold out for months.
You know, that's, again, an indication that advertisers feel that good times are back or that the economy is getting stronger, and they're investing in these types of shows to celebrate that.
And with a 100-million-person audience, Adgate says this big game is still one of the best investments an advertiser can make. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We did a staff survey around here of favorite Super Bowl ads this afternoon. You can see our staff's picks and share your own at marketplace.org. Mine? No ads, man. TiVo changes your life. On Wall Street today, the sad happy music. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama cut short his visit to Wisconsin today. Didn't want to get stuck there because of the heavy snows that are on their way to Washington. But while he was on the ground, he spoke more about investing in infrastructure and innovation as a way to win the future, the main theme of the speech he made last night. President has also been reaching out lately to business leaders to fill some high-profile White House vacancies. Commentator Robert Reich says some caution is in order there.
It's politically important for the president, any president, to court big corporations. They have the money, they have increasing political power, their decisions affect millions of Americans. But it's also important that the president not be seduced into believing, or seduce the public into thinking, the interests of big corporations are identical to the interests of most Americans. We've come a long way from the 1950s when GM's CEO, Engine Charlie Wilson, tapped to be Eisenhower's Secretary of Defense, voiced the conventional view that what was good for GM is good for America. Today, GM is making more cars in China than in the U.S. GE's CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, was just tapped to head the president's new Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. GE is doing bang-up business in China, India, and Brazil, but for years, it's also been closing factories all over America. I'm not criticizing GM or GE or any big company. They're doing exactly what they were set up to do, maximize the value of their shares. And in a global economy, they'll do that however and wherever they can, even if it means shifting jobs abroad or replacing employees with software and computers or pushing workers for more concessions on wages and benefits or fighting their unions. This is one reason corporate profits are soaring and the Dow is flirting with 12,000, as if we never had a great recession. But American workers continue to struggle. There's no trickle down. It's all trickle out to investments and investors around the world. So by all means, Mr. President, reach out to big business. Tell CEOs how important it is that they create jobs here in America, pay their American workers better wages and benefits, and get behind efforts to improve the education and skills of all Americans. But don't expect them to do any of this unless it helps their bottom lines. And be careful of their economic advice, too. Corporations are in business to make money, not jobs. They won't sacrifice profits to patriotism.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. David Frum is up in the rotation next week. In the meanwhile, send us your comments, marketplace.org. Click on contact. The C&B scene place this week is Davos, Switzerland. The World Economic Forum is beginning. 2,500 people pondering everything from the global recovery to climate change. From the European Desk Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Let's be frank. The forum's agenda doesn't sound exactly riveting.
The role of the annual meeting in Davos is to provide a systemic, strategic overview about all what's important on the global agenda.
As the forum's founder, Klaus Schwab, explains, it's all about complexity and interconnectedness, or according to the forum's official title this year, shared norms for the new reality. What does that mean?
I don't think it makes any sense to anybody at all except overpaid consultants who come up with this dribble.
That's London-based fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart. He's what you might call a Davos skeptic.
Davos is a commercial operation designed effectively to be really rather no more than a more upmarket, a face-to-face Facebook.
So it's all about networking, in your view?
It's a huge networking operation.
35 national leaders, including the Russian and French presidents, the British Prime Minister and the German Chancellor will be there. So will the US Treasury Secretary. China is sending its largest ever delegation. Chris Rowley of the Cass Business School says the Chinese want to flex their economic muscles.
They feel they need to be taken seriously as a world player. I mean, it's not just the sweatshop of the world producing thousands of cheap T-shirts. They see themselves as an important economic entity in their own right. So it's to reflect that glory almost.
There are many workshops and seminars on the subject of China. And rather alarmingly for the US, there's a session called Reshaping the American Economy, which is led by a Chinese academic. Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times, speaking from Davos, says the waning of American dominance has been obvious at these gatherings for some years.
The days of maybe, 10 years ago, even 7, 8 years ago, when people looked above all to the Americans for guidance as to how things were going to be economically, politically, those days are over. Now there's a competing array of voices here in Davos.
And a competing array of issues under discussion. The global recovery. Is the financial system back on track? And what about climate change, world poverty and the Eurozone crisis? Cynics dismiss all this as a pointless gabfest. But if it were, says Rachman, Bill Gates and other heavy hitters wouldn't turn up. Where else would they find so many rich, powerful and clever people to do deals with in one place?
You can meet the head of the IMF, the head of the World Bank, leaders of the Eurozone, the Chancellor of Germany, Bill Gates, the head of the Bank of America, whatever. They're all here.
And there's the usual sprinkling of showbiz glitz. At least one movie star will attend the forum this year.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
Actor and director Robert De Niro, who will no doubt adopt a less aggressive tone in the Davos talking shop this week. This is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, it's not easy being green, when you work from home and it's really cold outside.
Every time that I have a technician service it, he kind of stumbles out of the basement and says, "Lady, I never saw a furnace that old."
But first, Let's do the numbers. Over, under, over, and under again. The Dow Industrials breached 12,000 today for the first time since 2008, but closed a hair short at 11,985. That's a gain of 8 points, almost a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 0.75%, finished at 2739. The S&P 500 picked up 5 points, 0.4%, ended things at 1296. We call this, by the way, the sad happy music, because, yes, the Dow is up, but stocks are where they were 2 years ago. Boeing's falling profit and cloudy forecast sent its shares into a descent of 0.3% today, but the plane maker's customers climbed on the prospect of higher fares. United and Continental thrust up 7%. U.S. Airways gained 6.6%. American Airlines shook off its skirmishes with online travel sites. Its parent company, AMR, rose 2.5%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by iShares Exchange-Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for December. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for December. And the Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship talks up innovation in economically disadvantaged rural and traditionally underserved areas. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Nassau County on Long Island, just east of New York City, is in a little bit of a jam. Can't seem to handle its own finances, despite being one of the richest places in the country. A state oversight board took control of Nassau County's books today, just the latest in a long list of troubles for state and local government finances. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is here to discuss. Hey, Heidi.
Hi, Kai.
So we're going to take this news out of Nassau County in New York today and turn it into a conversation about the municipal bond market and some of the perils that are lurking there now. First of all, though, remind us what munis are, would you?
A municipal bond is just a bond that a city or a state issues so that it can raise money for education or water or sewage or all of those other really necessary support services that we all take for granted.
And as an investment opportunity and as a way that they play out through the whole economy, they're in 401ks, they're in pensions funds, they're everywhere.
That's right. They're tax exempt. So they've traditionally been considered a really safe investment. And generally, they always pay. But in the past 2 months, we've seen a panic in the muni market, and they're not looking as good as they once did.
Okay. Why? Why are we seeing that panic? Strong word, by the way.
But that's exactly what it's been. There have been so many investors selling out of their muni holdings that we have lost about a third of all of the investments that have been put into the muni market since January 2009. And it's hard to say what the cause of it is. A lot of panics are psychological, but a lot of people worry that it might be about upcoming state budgets, which are going to be quite a fight. A lot of states are cash-strapped right now, and they may not want to raise taxes, and they'll have a lot of trouble squaring their revenues with what they're spending, particularly on pensions.
Okay, so play that out for me a little bit. If, let's just say, Nassau County wants to sell some municipal bonds, it is in the marketplace now, not only competing with that panic, but also literally other investors, Joe Blow in Sheboygan, who has a muni bond who he wants to sell, right?
And that's a big problem for these municipalities because they'll still need to raise a lot of money this year. In fact, more money than they did last year. But as we've talked about, there's a panic. And so demand is likely to be low. And we also had Build America bonds, which were very popular and which took a lot of that demand out of the market.
Those bonds as part of the stimulus program.
That's right.
You are working on a story about state bankruptcies. And I don't want to steal your thunder here, but all this chatter that's been out there about state bankruptcies has also been affecting the muni market.
Primarily for the worse. Because the worst thing that you want to think about when you are buying a municipal bond is that there might be a default, that that municipality would not be able to pay you back what it owes you. And there are rules. States can't default, for instance. Mm-hmm. So generally, munis have been safe. But this year, there is this talk of bankruptcy. It's not coming from the states, God knows, because they don't want anyone thinking they could go bankrupt. But Congress is thinking about putting these precautions into effect so that states can have a better negotiating position when they want to cut pensions or other state services.
In theory, saying, hey, if you don't help us out with these negotiations, we're just going to declare bankruptcy and you'll be on your own.
Exactly. It's the nuclear option.
Heidi Moore, our New York Bureau Chief. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's Wednesday. You know what that means. Time to hit the inbox. I talked to Jane McGonigal last week about her theory that the skills people learn playing online games can help us solve real-world problems. One of those skills, McGonigal said, is a willingness to fail repeatedly, like 4 times out of 5, but to keep on trying anyway. That seems a little high to Daniel Davis of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Some gamers fail 80% of the time. That sounds like the most frustrating game ever. Game research has shown that if players aren't successful after a few attempts, many will give up. In fact, companies spend millions on testing for this exact reason, balancing fun with difficulty. I agree gamers are creative, but they're not as resilient as you'd think.
Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reported last week on local government land grabs over there. He started by noting that the Chinese Constitution devotes just one sentence to the taking of private property. Joshua McGee heard the program here in Los Angeles.
It should be noted that the United States Constitution devotes a single clause of one sentence to the issue, namely, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation, which is surely as vague as the Chinese wording.
Call this an editor's note, I guess, but it seems to me the difference between the two countries is that line about just compensation in the U.S. Constitution. In our weekly wrap last week, Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine weighed in on the Sino-American trade relationship. She said we ought to be happy for all those cheap Chinese imports that we're getting. And that made Laura Rizzi of Washington, New Hampshire, distinctly unhappy.
The reason things from China are almost free is because their workers are expendable. They don't have OSHA safety standards, and they don't have any standards to protect them.
Please tell us what you think about our standards. Go to our website, marketplace.org. The link to write to us is up at the top of that page. You can leave your comments there, and you can also find links to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. You know, if the powers that be at Marketplace would only agree to rig up a studio in my garage, I would be all set. I wouldn't ever have to set foot in the friendly confines of the Frank Stanton Studios ever again. But my issues aside, technology has made telecommuting pretty easy. Tens of millions of people work from home at least once in a while. And for years, we've been told that avoiding the drive into the office is a bonus for the environment. But it turns out that like so many other things, it's just not that easy. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill has the story.
This was supposed to be a story answering a pretty simple question. Does telecommuting make sense for the environment? The easy answer is not always, but the real answer is much, much more complicated.
I'm Sharon Forrest, and I work from home in Atlanta, Georgia.
Forrest, an administrative assistant for a psychotherapist. She handles most of the paperwork, phone calls, and scheduling from her home.
I have an open hour at 2 o'clock.
She makes the 43-mile round-trip drive to the office only once a week. And all those driving miles saved make Forrest's setup seem like an environmental slam dunk. Except it's been cold in Atlanta this winter, and Forrest's furnace is old.
Every time that I have a technician service it, he kind of stumbles out of the basement and says, "Lady, I never saw a furnace that old."
That old furnace from the 1920s is really inefficient, and she wouldn't use it if she was out of the house.
it's quite possible to generate more energy from the building standpoint by telecommuting than you save.
Patricia Mokhtarian is a professor at the University of California, Davis. Mokhtarian says the environmental calculation for each person that chooses to work from home will be different, depending on driving habits, infrastructure, and geography. For example, telecommuters in temperate Los Angeles need less energy for heat in the winter than folks in Chicago.
And, of course, then you want to look at the next step back and ask, where does the energy come from? So in a region where the energy is largely from coal, then you could be talking about more emissions in the long run than, obviously, in a place where it's cleaner energy.
Is your head spinning yet? There are other factors to consider before feeling all environmentally virtuous about staying home. New computers, furniture, lighting, clothing, food. Researchers at Cal Berkeley created a formula to analyze the impact of working at home. Here's just part of the calculation.
Type of house, floor area used for work, space constructed specifically for telework purposes or not, house used per 7-day week.
And on and on. Even situations that seem bad for the environment, clearly bad, are hard to sort out.
I am either on the phone or in front of the computer or both all day long.
Amanda Hickman works out of her home in Brooklyn. She used to bike to work, so telecommuting doesn't save any gasoline. And now, instead of going into an office, she heats her drafty brownstone.
I think it would be a lot more efficient to be off in a space where someone's already heating it and someone's already cooling it instead of me being camped out in my little apartment, heating the whole apartment for one person.
But, and here's the but, there's no office for Hickman not to go to. So there's no duplicate desk being wasted or heat being wasted. There aren't extra computers or phones. And so again, it's complicated. Lame, I know. But there are simpler answers for the ecologically minded that start with simpler questions. How do you use energy? Can you cut that down? According to the federal government, 3/4 of us, when we do go into work, drive in our cars all alone. And so for 3/4 of us, the solution could be as simple as sharing a ride. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by iShares Exchange Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an ode to the $3 checkoff box on your tax return, the one that lets part of your taxes be used to help publicly finance presidential campaigns. This morning, House Republicans introduced a bill to get rid of that $3 contribution and force presidential candidates to pay their own way. GOP leaders say it'll save more than $500 million over 10 years. It is worth a note, though, that the first candidate to opt out of public financing in the general election campaign did pretty well for himself. He's the guy who gave that big speech last night. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 8 points, almost 0.1%, flirted with, crossed briefly the 12,000 mark before settling back down. The NASDAQ gained 20 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 picked up 5 points, 0.4%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, before you toss that garbage in a landfill, do us all a favor and think again, huh?
You're literally throwing money and energy into a big pit in the ground. There are dollars in trash. Trash is energy.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.